tonight was to be a panel discussion, and the unfortunately Dora Lee, who was to be the other panelist, is ill and is unable. Decided that she would be just too taxed to come and join the panel tonight. So I am the panel of one. And I'm going to be talking about these teachings that were offered here at the Dharma Center, at the behest of the Dharma Center, to representatives of the three sanghas who inhabit this place, on Buddhist teachings on communal and social harmony. So I was thinking that some people here, some people that come to this group, may think of themselves as Zen students. And thank you for thinking of yourself that way. That's wonderful. I wonder how many people who come to the group think of themselves as students of the Buddha Dharma, which is slightly different than thinking of yourself as a Zen student, maybe, or maybe a little different orientation. As we remember the description of the Buddhist path, the path is described as having three general tracks, and these tracks are called in the Old Testament Sila, Samadhi, and Prajna. Or morality, or ethical conduct, practices related to mental development, cultivation of the mind, or cultivation of our sitting practice, and then prajna, which is wisdom. Wisdom being the apprehension of the ultimate nature of reality. So I think I was thinking that a lot of times here we talk quite a bit about samadhi and prajna. We spend quite a bit of time. In fact, tonight I was giving beginning meditation instruction, and I was talking almost exclusively about practices related to mental cultivation, to samadhi, to this concentration practice that we do in sitting meditation. And it seems, and other Zen teachers, including my own teacher, have noted that Zen students may tend to neglect the practice of, or the track of the path called sila, or ethical conduct, may tend not to just pay as much attention to that track as to the other aspects of the other two. Aspects of the path. And certainly for myself, I confess that when I came to practice, I didn't think I needed any teachings myself about ethical conduct or morality. In fact, I would suspect that my attitude was something like, that's my business, and not the business of some Zen Center or some teachings that I'm going to receive there. What I'm interested in getting from that Zen Center is this sitting practice. That's what I want to get. I want to get that. And then when I heard about the wisdom part, I was open to that too. I was open to hearing about that. But it, you know, I have to say that I think in my training in the early days of my practice, not only wasn't I paying so much attention to ethical conduct, I don't think the general milieu was paying so much attention to that. We were in the period of expressing ourselves in whatever way felt right. And so oftentimes this didn't necessarily seem to talk of morality or ethical conduct could potentially make us feel a little uncomfortable. So I think it's actually a wonderful corrective to have someone come along, and in recent years a number of people have come along, including, as I say, my own teacher, Reb Anderson, have come along and say, remember about that third track, that track of ethical conduct? We need to pay attention to that. We're maybe a little one-sided or a little two-sided, samadhi and prajna-sided versus the track of ethical conduct. And we need to turn our attention to that a little more. And I think Reb Anderson, who's my teacher, recognized that, and he wrote this book called Being Upright, which is on the precepts, the Bodhisattva precepts. And he has told me that he has written several books, but he has told me that of all the books that he has written, that book to him he feels the best about, because he feels that like it's a book that people really use. They really, and maybe it's because, you know, some of us were neglecting that side of our practice, and because part of really joining the way in Zen or in any other Buddhist tradition is to take the precepts, to take the vows of the precepts, and so to really to put that in its proper place, which is equal to the other two tracks of the path. So we had these wonderful teachings here on ethical conduct, or particularly related to teachings that the Buddha gave about how to get along with each other. And this is important because here at the Sacramento Dharma Center, we have three groups with different orientations towards and different understandings of what we're doing here. I was going to say Buddhism. I'm not sure actually all the groups here think we're doing Buddhism. So whatever we're doing here, we need to have find some common ground. Now, we thought when we started the place that the common ground was this, or however other people sit, but anyway, sitting, that was the common ground. But and that is a tremendous unifying force for the three groups that sit here, and it's wonderful that I can say, as I just did in beginning meditation instruction to the people here, if you don't like the Zen, if the Zen approach, you know, doesn't appeal to you, well, this place offers other opportunities. If you can't deal with the ritual aspects of what's going on in Zen practice, there's other possibilities here. We're all united in this. And you can go get instruction on how to do this from the other groups. But they're all going to be asking you to sit down on a cushion and be quiet and engage with your consciousness, your mind. So we had these these wonderful teachings offered on how to get along, and the teachings were offered by Alan Sinaki, but based on some wonderful work that a fellow named Bhikkhu Bodhi did. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with Bhikkhu Bodhi. He's not a Zen teacher, but he's a brilliant exponent of the Buddha Dharma. And this is why I made the point in the beginning. It's worth our while to pay attention to some brilliant exponents of the Buddha Dharma. And Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is actually an American, a Caucasian person, a New York Jewish person, who not a Sri Lankan person like his name may sound, although he practiced in Sri Lanka for a good amount of time. He is a brilliant character and a wonderful writer and speaker. He has written and edited a ton of Buddhist work. He founded an organization to make an effort to address world hunger and to empower women in various cultures that are underserved. And so one of the things that he did was he compiled teachings. He reached into the, well, using his extensive knowledge of the Old Testament, which for us is the Pali Canon. The Pali Canon, it's called. The oldest teachings that were written down, some of the oldest teachings that were written down after the life of the Buddha, and professed to be the actual Buddha word. He used his extensive knowledge of that corpus of work to assemble this book that brings forth teachings on this subject of how to get along, how we can get along. And he makes a really good a point that's really been kind of turning in me is that these teachings, the teachings on ethical conduct, they're not some secondary, oh, by the way, you know, teachings, but actually they are integral. They are an integral part of the Buddha's awakening. They are just as much a part of the Buddha's awakening as any direct perception he had into the nature of reality and into any engagement in sitting meditation that brought him to that perception. So he's written something at the beginning of his well, I don't actually know where it is in the book. We didn't get the book. We got a series of excerpts from the book by PDF to be able to read, and so they were freely given to us. And he's written something on right view, which is of course the first aspect of the Eightfold Noble Path. Right view or right understanding. The usual way we think about right view, or the way I've been taught to think about it, is that right view basically looks back at the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path. It looks back at the Four Noble Truths and says, that's the right understanding, that's the right view. But that's sort of the absolute understanding of of right view. And I'd like to just read you what he wrote to kind of round out the picture, because I think it's quite good. He says, "The Buddha taught that right understanding or right view is the forerunner on the path to liberation. He assigned right view to the position of the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, the way to end suffering, and held that all other factors of the path must be guided by right view toward the goal of his teaching, the cessation of suffering. For the Buddha, however, right view plays a critical role not only on the path of liberation, but also to the attainment of well-being and happiness within the cycle of rebirth." So, in the here and now, not just liberation from the cycle, but within the cycle. I think that's so important. It does this by underscoring the need for ethical conduct. The right view integral to the moral life is sometimes called mundane right view, or the right view of one's personal responsibility for one's deeds. This kind of right view is based on the premise that there is an objective, transcendent basis for morality that is not dependent on human judgments and opinions. Okay? It's not we can just do our own thing and that's none of your business. According to the Buddha's awakening, this kind of right view is based on the premise that there is an objective, transcendent basis for morality, not dependent on human judgments and opinions. Through his enlightenment, the Buddha discovered this moral law and derived from it the specific ethical injunctions of his teaching. On the basis of this discovery, the Buddha holds the validity of moral distinctions is built into the fabric of the cosmos. Moral judgments can be distinguished as true and false, action determined as good and bad, with reference to a moral law that is just as efficacious, just as universal in its operation, as the laws of physics and chemistry. As moral agents, therefore, we cannot justify our actions simply by appealing to personal preferences, nor can we expect following our preferences to secure our well-being. Rather, to achieve true well-being, we must act in conformity with moral law, which is the Dharma itself, the fundamental principle of truth and goodness that abides whether or not the Buddhas discover and reveal it. So this, you know, this is some wonderful stuff right there, and this understanding. I did want to mention, I was going to mention this earlier, but I do want to mention that we don't here in our practice place completely ignore these moral teachings. In fact, we do this thing called the full moon ceremony. And that is the in a monastic setting you would be doing that once a month. You would be doing the full moon ceremony. You would be reciting the 16 bodhisattva precepts, and you would confessing that you're in the thrall of ancient twisted karma or unwholesome habits of body and mind. So we only, as you know, meet once a month, once a week, and so it doesn't seem appropriate, it hasn't seemed appropriate to me that we should do the full moon ceremony like every month, because a lot of you don't come for that, for one thing. And because you know we have to do a lot of bowing, and also it's repetitious, right? We say the same thing over and over again. We repeat the vows each time. And many people may think, well, I know what they're going to do. that night they're just going to repeat those vows over, and I've heard those before, so I won't go tonight. Well, of course, we all have the freedom to do that. But there is a value. There's a value in coming and repeating those vows over and over again, and considering them, because each time you will hear something new, you will hear something, and something in there may be relevant to your current situation. So I did a little, I wrote down a little, in the ceremony we say, in the full moon ceremony we say, all my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. So for some reason, I wrote down, I thought, okay, I'm going to make this really clear, or what does this mean when we say that? And so I wrote this different version of that, which we could say if we wanted to, but we probably won't because we like to say it the old way. But I'll tell you this version. All our unwholesome actions and habits of mind motivated by greed, hate, and delusion. We let greed, hate, and delusion motivate us. Act it out through body, speech, and mind. I'm trying to put this in more contemporary language, right? I now completely take responsibility for it. I now completely take responsibility for it. So that's what we're saying when we're saying that. So the reason I mentioned that is I wanted to. Go over some of these teachings that we we received in this workshop, and I thought one of the most sympathetic teachings to me is this teaching, because it is based on an introspective review of what we're doing. Mio once said a phrase that stuck with me a long time. He probably said this years ago, but he said this phrase: "We're always using mindfulness to comb through our motivations." The motivations for our actions and the nature of our actions. We're always using mindfulness to comb through and to really say, really ask ourselves, am I on point here? Am I acting correctly toward people? Did I act correctly toward that person who I just interacted with? Like Charles and I had an interaction last week and I've been combing through that one this week. I've been combing through that act, wonder if the way I talk was really respectful to Charles, and whether how I wasn't sure how that we had a very good communication, and so my mind was turning towards that during the week. So I think this is what, this is how the nature of practice kind of works, this kind of review. So, this is a passage from Bhikkhu Bodhi's, it's just his translations, right? But this is from the Pali Canon. And this is one we studied in our seminar. Now, friends, a monk ought to infer about himself in the following way. A person with evil wishes and dominated by evil wishes is displeasing and disagreeable to me. If I were to have evil wishes and be dominated by evil wishes, I would be displeasing and disagreeable to others. A monk who knows this should arouse his mind thus: I shall not have evil wishes and be dominated by evil wishes. It goes on. A person who lauds himself and disparages others, a person who adheres to his own views, holds on to them tenaciously, and relinquishes them with difficulty, is displeasing and disagreeable to me. If I were to adhere to my own views, hold on to them tenaciously, and relinquish them with difficulty, I would be disagreeable and displeasing to others. A monk who knows this should arouse his mind thus: I shall not adhere to my own views, hold on to them tenaciously, and I shall relinquish them easily. Now, friends, a monk should review himself thus: Do I have evil wishes, and am I dominated by evil wishes? If, when he reviews himself, he knows, I have evil wishes, I am dominated by evil wishes, then he should make an effort to abandon those evil, unwholesome states. But if, when he reviews himself, he knows, I have no evil wishes, I am not dominated by evil wishes, then he can abide happy and glad, training night and day in wholesome states. Again, a monk should review herself thus: Do I praise myself and disparage others? Do I adhere to my own views, hold on to them tenaciously, and relinquish them with difficulty? If, when she reviews herself, she knows, I adhere to my own views, then she should make an effort to abandon those evil and unwholesome states. But if, when he reviews, she reviews herself, she knows, I do not adhere to my own views, then she can be happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. So I think this is your practice is working, if you'll excuse me for saying so. Your practice is working if you are reviewing within yourself whether and how tenaciously you're holding on to your own views. And whether you are able or not to relinquish them. I'm about to... Oh, this is an announcement. I'm about to join a small committee here at the Sacramento Dharma Center that is going to attempt to reach some kind of agreement on a permanent altar for this room. A permanent altar that would be acceptable to all of the groups that meet here. I have some views about that altar and what it should look like, what images it should have. I already have a plan, okay? I have a wonderful plan. I have a superior plan. But if I go into this meeting thinking like that and holding on to that, this meeting is not going to go well. And this is going to be a difficult meeting. It's going to be really hard. I anticipate, maybe I'll be wrong, but I anticipate that it's going to be pretty hard because there are divergent views about this space right here. I think we got to the point already where we think there should be something here. So that's good. But we haven't even had a meeting yet, so you know, we don't know. But there's a field out there for holding on to views, and that's you know, where this teaching, we had this teaching. Maybe I should read this teaching at the beginning of our meeting, because we're really going to have to work on how we deal with. Because actually, some people have already announced what sounds like kind of fixed view, like that they're going to hold on to. So we'll see how it goes. But presumably, we didn't have these sessions reading these texts in vain. So we probably should bring this text, this particular text, to the meeting and ring it, read it, and in hopes that it can somehow inform what we're doing there. So I don't know if you have any instances, if you've ever had any experience of holding on to a view, or having difficulty relinquishing a view in conjunction with others. But if you'd like to mention anything like that, and we could have some confession, or we could have some you know, stories of graceful activity.
I don't think I'm going to confess anything, but no, the idea of reviewing what you did, and I think it could somehow get into beating yourself up too. That's kind of a, how do you know when you're not, oh man, I shouldn't have said that, and I really, you know, it wasn't really anything big, but I was just got back from Costa Rica, and we had a really good guide, and we went into a Catholic church, and he said people came to the basilica, it was a basilica, and asked for miracles and stuff, and so he went up to the altar and kneeled, and when he came back, I sort of made a joke. I said, oh, did you ask for a miracle? And then I thought, you know, I shouldn't have made light of his beliefs, but I don't think he really took it wrong. But so I've been thinking since that 3 days ago, like, I wonder if I shouldn't have said that, and maybe I should email him and say sorry, and or am I forgetting that? And anyways, that's just where I'm coming from with that. I guess I did confess something.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. So so there's something in there about. It sounded like he didn't take it badly.
No, he didn't. And I just thought, well, I was, in my mind, I thought I was kind of making a little joke, and I didn't disparage his beliefs, but it could have been a little bit too far. I don't know.
I think the tendency to be jokey and flippant can often get us in trouble. I have been guilty of that more than once. I will confess, I said something at one of these meetings that I've been turning ever since. Some people at the meeting, I won't say who, and I don't think I'm oversharing to say this. Some people at this meeting of multiple sanghas, right, representatives of multiple sanghas, they confessed that they had what they called a fear of Zen. And in other words, they were dedicated practitioners of the way in their school, but they're very fearful about entering this hall on Monday nights. They're very fearful, and the reason they're fearful is they think they're going to do something wrong. They're going to make a mistake. They're going to look bad. Well, no, they didn't say that. I take that back. They didn't say that. They just said, I think I'll make a mistake. and I don't want to make a mistake. I don't want to. So probably most everybody who's gone to a Zen center probably has that fear. And it is kind of a barrier. It's kind of a barrier for us. If you haven't experienced this kind of practice and you come and the people are doing what we're doing, especially after Zazen, and we do service and we start bowing, we start chanting, we start dedicating the chant to people that lived long ago or maybe only lived in somebody's very active imagination, then that's hard, and people can be afraid of that. So anyway, these people confessed that they... I feel kind of ashamed that I'm about to say this, but I'll say it since I want to confess it. So I said, my flippant comment was, oh, well, it used to be fear of flying. Now it's fear of Zen. I don't know. I didn't feel good about it afterwards. I thought that was a little flippant and weird, you know.
You should have said it's fear of yoga.
So I don't feel good about that comment, and when I see those people, I'm actually going to say, I think that comment was kind of off. I apologize for, you know, saying things that way. So yeah, one of the things can get you in trouble is being clever, right? That was kind of a clever thing to say, but it wasn't necessarily, you know, a wise thing to say. It was kind of cleverly stupid. So, you know, we have to be careful. Yvonne.
On that note, I was thinking what you shared with us, that excerpt. It said evil wishes. And in my mind, evil is extreme. I mean, when I hear that word evil, it's kind of, you know, the end of the road there. But I think, for me, anyway, more helpful to say unkind or uncompassionate or something not quite so severe, so that I, you know, because I can easily dismiss, I don't think I'm evil. I just don't think I am. But I am very unkind sometimes. And that I can see, and I can look at that forever.
Right. Well,
but you know, it's interesting because I was thinking about the same thing you say, which I appreciate. I can see that I'm unkind sometimes. But I think, other than the extremes of someone who is just a lousy bastard and he knows it and he doesn't care, most of people fall into the realm of they don't think they're doing harm. They want to be good people, but maybe they're not. Other people don't perceive them that way. So it's a really interesting question as to how do you see yourself? Is the intention to be good alone enough alone, or is there more? And you were suggesting that there is laws from up above that we all, you know. So it's just an interesting thought.
Well, two things. We have to remember this is the Old Testament, as I say. So in the real Old Testament, you know, they use a lot of more extreme language than we use today. In Buddhist Old Testament, Pali Canon, they were more likely to use that kind of word. So I think it's appropriate for us to make substitutions in our own mind, like you've done, you can substitute a word there that makes sense for the way you used language, or you had a wish to use language. Maybe you didn't use it, but you had a wish to use some language that was unkind. So I think it's appropriate to substitute and understand this is very old language. And then the other thing is in response to you is, you know, I don't think that the moral code of Buddhism comes down to us from on high. It's just that what Buddha announced in terms of the morality is saying there is a moral order to the universe. There is a moral order. There is no, for instance, there is no universe that we can see where intentional killing of another being is morally good. We can't see that universe. And we can't see a universe. There isn't a revealed universe where stealing from another, where taking from another what is not given is morally good. So these things are, in terms of his vision, he couldn't see a universe. He had a big vision, but he didn't see a universe where those things were wholesome.
So, there is that teaching of the Buddha, remember when he met, he was on a boat. He was going to kill thousands of people, and so the Buddha killed that person because he knew if he didn't, this person would go on to kill thousands.
Wow. I haven't heard that story.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. That's the Buddha killed somebody. Oh, boy.
You better bring that next week.
Yeah.
You know, under the law, that would not be a defense in today. In other words, if you're about to kill this person, I cannot claim self-defense if I kill you to prevent you from killing that person. I would be locked away.
Well, yeah, because who really has the foresight to know?
Yeah. Who has the right?
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Oscar?
My understanding of evil is karmic actions that are based on ignorance and the anger and hatred that is associated with it. So this is a very expansive view of evil. But all those actions of body, speech, and mind, which are based on wrong understanding of how things are. And the way things are is the universe doesn't kill. And doesn't steal and doesn't misuse sexuality and so forth. I find it hard to justify what I just said, because of course there is a lot of all those things
sure.
in the universe. But actually everything is working together in such a way that everything supports everything else. You know, this is a sort of universalist view. And if you understand, as I think the Buddha teaches, that everything does support everything else, which means that you're being supported by and are supporting everything, then there's no stinginess at all. Right from the beginning, there's never been anything else than everything helping me right now to say what I'm saying right now and be here with you and so forth, and for you to be here. So,
There is killing, there is stealing, there are all these things. It's just that there's no universe in which these things are wholesome. That's the point.
And the reason they're not wholesome is they're not congruent with the way things actually are.
Right.
The way everything is working together.
Right.
That's why. So
they're congruent with the bigger vision,
yeah.
Or they're congruent with the vision of wisdom and codependent arising and so forth. I mean, it's all congruent.
I'd also like to report something. You mentioned Rev Anderson, your teacher, is also my teacher. And I had an experience where my teacher approached me, actually called me, and reminded me about something that had happened. And I hadn't remembered it. And, you know, we discussed it. And, oh, yes, I remember that. And he basically asked for my forgiveness because he thought maybe it was disrespectful. He had been combing I don't know if he'd been doing the whole time, but at some point he was combing back through his memory and felt it, I guess, was moved to clear his karma.
Mm-hmm.
I was very impressed by that as an example of humility and rigorous, strenuous adherence to the Buddha way. Also, it happened, I was speaking with him very recently, and I was speaking with him about a meeting I anticipated, or some relationship I anticipated, where I expected there to be potential conflict, and how would I deal with that? And the thrust of his response was, don't cling to your ideas. Which is also a theme he covered in the yesterday or Saturday. So it was very much reinforcing and substantiating the points you were making a little bit ago.
Yeah. Well, the points that are made in these texts.
Yes.
Yeah.
I had difficulty with the evil, good and evil, and I feel I got some resolution with that when I was getting some gelato, and I decided I'm going to get the coffee. My coffee is good, and all the others are evil.
Just so.
And that works for me.
It helps you sort out your decision making, your preferences. Just call all your non preferences evil. Okay. Well, that's
Millard.
That's uniquely
Millard.
I think Millard's not so much trapped in the words. He's not abiding in the ideas of some words. Words really can mess us up.
There's some wonderful teachings in here, and we're nearing the end of our time. These texts were freely given. I think I can freely pass them on to the webmaster and have them posted on the website for people to look at. I would like to close with.
Do you have all three of them, Jim?
I do.
Okay.
I have the whole thing. I wanted to close with a part of what I quoted in the email announcement this week. This is called the Harmonious Assembly. I think we have a pretty harmonious assembly here. We don't live together. we don't bump heads so much. And we need more opportunities in this Sangha to bump heads. And I have some ideas how we can do that, because it's really important. The more we work together, the more we interact, the more we do things together as a sangha, the more opportunity we have to bump heads, and that's where the real work, that's where the real juice is that we interact and we find out our rough edges. And we make mistakes, and we apologize for the mistakes, just like a teacher apologizes to a student, and we become more intimate. So we need more opportunities like that, and like I say, I have some ideas, but I won't go into those tonight. But I did want to read something called, this is from that same group of readings, it's called The Harmonious Assembly, Two Kinds of Assemblies. There are monks, the divided assembly and the harmonious assembly. What is the divided assembly? What is the divided assembly? Here, the assembly in which the monks take to arguing and quarreling and fall into disputes, stabbing each other with piercing words, is called the divided assembly. What is the harmonious assembly? Here, the assembly in which the monks dwell in concord, harmoniously, without disputes, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with eyes of affection, is called the harmonious assembly. When the monks dwell in concord, harmoniously, without disputes, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with eyes of affection, on that occasion, they generate much merit. On that occasion, the monks dwell in a divine abode, that is, in the liberation of mind through altruistic joy. When one is joyful, rapture arises. When one, with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. One feeling pleasure, for one feeling pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. Just as when it is raining and the rain pours down in thick droplets on a mountaintop, the water flows down the slope and fills the cleft and gullies and creeks. These becoming full fill up the pools. These becoming full fill up the lakes. These becoming full fill up the streams. These becoming full fill up the rivers. These becoming full fill up the ocean. So too, when the monks dwell in concord, harmoniously, without disputes, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with eyes of affection, on that occasion they generate much merit. On that occasion, the monks dwell in a divine abode, that is, in the liberation of the mind through altruistic joy. When one is joyful, rapture arises. For one with a rapturous mind, the body becomes tranquil. One tranquil in body feels pleasure. One feeling pleasure, the mind. Becomes concentrated. So this is a very sweet passage, of course, and it is interesting that he links this harmonious assembly to the four jhanas. You know, the four stages of meditative concentration. So, this seems like this harmonious assembly, this sangha, is a gateway for all of us for meditative concentration. So we need to, we do this together in harmony, and that produces the joyful, rapturous, tranquil, pleasurable, concentrated mind that we all really want. Thank you very much.